Well, welcome to Let's Talk About Thrones, where we get together and we talk about Game of Thrones. And we are now at season 5 of Game of Thrones. Today, we're going to talk about episodes 503, High Sparrow, episode 504, Sons of the Harpy. Once again, such a good pair that practically one scene just blends into the first scene at the start of the second episode, almost as if it were the same. Well, it is pretty much the same time, just a few minutes later. So we will start with 503, but before doing that, of course, we must introduce our talkers. And I'm one of the talkers. I am Richard Gunther, and I think I'm Sir Richard from somewhere, and I can never remember where. I am going to pass the greeting mic to Jenny.
Well, I'm Jenny from the wilds of New Jersey today.
Is that south of Westeros? Is that a new continent, or is that just like a different land? It's you creating your own establishment in the riverland somewhere.
There's a lake. I guess it's the Lakelands.
All right.
And I'm just going to go ahead and pick it up here. I am Sir Anthony from Winterfell, because Winterfell's huge, and that way I can hide easier. Plus, I'm in Alaska, so it just fits.
It kind of does. It kind of does. All right. Well, let's get started. We're going to take this again kind of by people's themes rather than trying to go as chronologically. So I want to start with Arya, because the episode 503 starts with Arya. And once again, we see that Arya is kind of just trying to figure out what's going on next in her life, as she is potentially trying to become a nobody, a person of no name. What do you call these people who are living in the House of Black and White?
A girl with no name.
A girl. Well, but they're all called men with no name. And interestingly enough, it's almost as if they reference that she would be a man with no name.
I mean, who needs labels, right?
Right. And that's really what you strive for, is there's that you don't have your own personal identity. You're an arm of the many-faced God in everything that you do. So, yeah, she's picking up chores. She's starting to earn her keep around there.
Right. Yeah. Alas, she is an apprentice. And as we all know from the fabled story, the Sorcerer's Apprentice, they start by sweeping the floors.
And then they get into trouble.
It's literally
exactly.
It's literally just like military service. You start by sweeping the floors, you get in trouble, and eventually a door opens, and you go through that door, and you start doing something else until you get in trouble.
Yep. So she sees some guy die, and I don't know that we necessarily know all of the circumstances there, except that this person goes to the guy whose name I can never pronounce. And it's almost as if he's blessed by him. Mm. And then moments later, the dude's dead.
Yeah. It kind of almost purposely leads you to not know exactly what's going on. It just gives you the overall to kind of fill in the blanks for yourself. And if you can't, then it doesn't really change the story, but it enhances it almost, because now it builds in just a little bit more mystery.
So Arya's frustrated. She's a little bit, I don't want to call her bratty, but she's getting a little bit frustrated and boisterous about it. So eventually then she's in her, I guess I'll call them quarters, and another woman comes in and asks her who she is. And she says, "I'm nobody." And she gets slapped. She's like, "No, you're not. Who are you?" "I'm nobody." She gets slapped again. And then Jakar Jahar, or whatever his name is, comes in and says, "You're not ready." And, "Yes, I am. I'm ready." "Well, then why do you have Arya Stark's sword and Arya Stark's clothes?" So she takes that challenge and gets rid of them all. Or, well, not all. Because, of course, she's not willing to get rid of Needle.
Right. And it's not like she keeps Needle in her possession. She just stashes it away in a hole she conveniently found that's exactly one sword's depth. and put some rocks on it, where maybe from her scene, her point of view, she couldn't see it, but it's clearly still a sword in there from the opposite angle from where the camera was.
Also, that is so cheating.
Yeah, it's really cheating, and it's not like taking a stand and saying, you know, this thing is important in and of itself. Now she's concealing.
Right.
Because it wasn't just a matter of, okay, I'll put this somewhere where I'll remember. She was actively concealing it, and I suspect she will then claim that she has discarded of it all. And when we next see her, she is then taken by Joshua through the secret door, where she is then just kind of quietly trying to figure out what she needs to do, which is apparently to help someone prepare or clean previously mentioned dead person for some reason. And we don't know why. Neither does Arya.
Right. And she actually starts asking questions that go unanswered.
Right. So. And thus ends our ride with Arya through these two episodes.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, this is one of those stories where just because you don't see Arya, you can still fill in that she's doing these things. Like, they've set the tone for Arya for the next little bit.
So, next up, I want to skip Cersei, who it was kind of technically next, but there's a lot going on there, so I kind of want to hold off on that. Let's stick with the sisters. Let's talk about Sansa next.
Okay.
So Littlefinger and Sansa are just, you know, taking a walk. They're on their way somewhere. It might be Winterfell. Who knows? Actually, they're overlooking some town of some sort. And I don't know what that is. Was that supposed to be Winterfell?
It is Winterfell. There's a little town right outside of Winterfell, but yeah, they're essentially back.
I think it's Whore's Town or wherever they go is for Winterfell for the whores.
Yeah.
Wherever like they found Tyrion back in episode one.
Yep.
So they're overlooking Winterfell. She doesn't seem all that excited to see it. She's like, it looks kind of terrible. And while they're overlooking this terrible version of Winterfell, Littlefinger is suggesting to her that, you know, you should probably marry this Ramsay guy.
Right, which Sansa doesn't know, but everyone who's ever seen an episode with him in it, we all know that's just not a good idea.
He's a monster.
And later on in the second episode, she actually mentions, his father's a monster, and Littlefinger says something along the lines of, "Oh well, you can shape Ramsay," and I was like, "I don't know that's how that's going to work out." Like that doesn't. The indications from the viewer are that that's less likely than one might suppose.
Now, question: one would not be naive. One must assume that Littlefinger knows exactly what Ramsay Bolton is like, right?
He at least knows how Roose Bolton is, and you can't think that his recently legitimized son has fallen far from that tree.
Right.
So I don't. This is one of those decisions. This whole story arc right here is one of the
challenging.
If I were to put a black eye on the series, it's this storyline right here. Mm-hmm. It culminates awesome. The how it eventually finishes is amazing, but this is a really, really rough sub story going on here.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well,
you know, the selling of women.
Yeah. The bartering of women. The who gives a crap about destroying land and just to try to rebuild it. Everything about this whole series of events is just creepy McCreeperston.
Mm-hmm. Right. Good way of describing it. And that just continues through this particular part of the story arc, because it's essentially him saying, okay, I'm going to do what I can to marry you off to them because that's what they want. And it could be good for you. I'm going to tell you the ways that it would be good for you. In fact, what'll probably happen is, you know, eventually Stannis and his army are going to come and take over Winterfell anyway. So I'm kind of putting you in harm's way, but no, don't worry. It'll work out well for you because Stannis will need you. Stannis will want a Stark by his side and will name you something, something of the North. I forget what that was going to be.
Mm-hmm. Wardeness of the North. Basically the female.
Wardeness of the North. Okay, right. Whatever that is. That sounds like a made up title to me.
It totally is. But here's the thing though, on this whole process, like if you just to watch the Littlefinger Sansa part of this, he says, okay, well, you're going to marry Ramsay. You'll be able to shape him how you need him. Oh, by the way, I'm getting the hell out of here. So when Stannis attacks, I'm not here, but he'll spare you. It's like, they needed a damsel to be in distress to rescue, so I'm going to put that in place, then I'm going to exit the story. Like it almost seems like Littlefinger is starting to lose his sense of understanding how the world actually works, and he's mm-hmm. building a fairy tale for him to live in.
Well, and what way to end a fairy tale but with a kiss?
Creepy McCreeperston.
Right. Right. Oh, God. Here we go again with yet another. I'm going to assume unwelcome because she completely does not react to it. Right.
Right.
And that was kind of like his icing on this cake of wardeness of the North that he just sold her. Such a weird, awkward continued relationship, so friggin' bizarre.
He kisses her in the crypts, and that's the least creepy part about it.
Yeah.
yes.
When will Littlefinger get what he deserves? Just when?
Obviously, he will, based on the way you're saying that.
No, I mean. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. the Winterfell, I don't say the Winterfell, the Littlefinger arc is like, there's so many just desserts that haven't formulated yet. Like, he's started all of this. Remember that. We now know that Littlefinger started the entire war. The whole, everything is started because of Littlefinger. When he helped Lady Arryn assassinate Jon Arryn, mm-hmm. you know, that's what started all of this. That's what led King Robert to go to the North to ask for Ned to be his hand. Like, all of this started because of Littlefinger.
Oh man,
interesting.
That's deep.
I had not made that association. Yeah,
yeah.
Remember, it was just in a recent episode that he said it.
Well, because he told Lady Arryn. Oh, well, Lady Arryn said, you know, I put this stuff in his drink, in John's drink, and this and that. So you told me that so we could be together. So he basically played off Lady Arryn, Lyza Arryn, in order to kill John Arryn. And that was how all of this started, was because John Arryn had died. So Robert had to go north to get Ned to become his hand. So
what's that thing you said? Chaos is a ladder?
Yes, chaos is a ladder. And man. Like this almost could be called the Littlefinger show, except for the people in the North that are dead and coming.
Well, now here's an interesting thing. That's a thing that was independently happening, right? Like, we have no suggestion that anything about that is other than of the Nightwalker's own, you know, decisions.
Meaning that they're not somehow also triggered by
Littlefinger?
They're not
pawns of Littlefinger, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right. That would be something, huh? Maybe we find that out in season 8.
That would be astounding.
All right, well, let's not get too hung up. Anything else that we want to talk about as far as Sansa is concerned? That's pretty much where we leave her.
Mm-hmm. Other than hang in there, sister.
Yeah.
Hang in there. Oh, well, I guess it's worth mentioning that Ramsay does promise Littlefinger that he will never hurt Sansa. Wait, I think I remember some other person claiming that he would never hurt Sansa. Who was that going to be? Oh, right. The obnoxious brat Joffrey.
Right. Yeah.
Well, that worked out well.
It sure did. Yeah, she got rescued by circumstance. I mean,
absolutely. Absolutely. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about Brienne and Pod. Let's have a little bit of a side conversation because this is what this is. This is a little character development. We find out a little bit more about Brienne's past. We find out a little bit more of Pod's past. And perhaps for the first time, Brienne actually respects Pod and decides to kind of help train him.
I think it's so Brienne and Jaime had this special relationship. They were kind of meant for each other in this special way. Brienne and Pod have the same sort of relationship. Like their entire existence would be different were it not for the other person. Pod is learning so much and he's learning to understand things, and he's a sponge for knowledge, and he's been pulling this knowledge unwillingly from Brienne this whole time. And this is the first time Brienne's like, okay, well, I can actually start treating you like a squire and we'll make this work. Meanwhile, Brienne this whole time has been doing this high and mighty, I'm a loner, I can do everything by myself and I don't need anybody. And this is the first time she's like, you know what? It's actually valuable having you here. And this begins a really beautiful part of their relationship. And I think Brienne is just a person that has to realize that she needs someone in order to need someone. It kind of recursive, but I think I'm getting my point across.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Makes sense. All right. Now we have a lot of stuff going on up at Castle Black.
Mm-hmm.
So let's kind of go through that stuff. And we're really seeing John for the first time as the leader of the Night's Watch. What is that title again?
Lord Commander.
Lord Commander. That's a good title. Like that.
It's like two strong things smashed
together.
Should
we call you that from now on?
Lord Commander Richard.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
But it does mean you have to always drive the podcast.
No, forget it then. I don't want that title.
Too late. You've been voted.
Yep.
I don't
still
have
voted.
That much
Dirty
honor.
Rule.
All right. So, Honoris John is now in command, and he's in a position where he needs to show in the course of two episodes that he can in fact command this group of tired and to some extent disenfranchised Night's Watch people. What do we call them? They're not knights, right? What are they?
The Watchers on the Wall.
Watchers
on the Wall.
The Night's Watch Watchers. Okay. I'll come up with a less redundant
way of
referring to
that. That sounds like
a
70s song by, like, I don't know who.
REO Speedwagon.
Yeah.
So we start with John where we left off, where, again, Stannis is trying to convince him to come with him and fight with him. And he declines Stannis' offer. Mm-hmm. And then we see Stannis' I can't remember the name of the guy that's working with Stannis.
Oh,
the Onion
Davos.
Knight.
So then Davos tries to convince Jon that no, he's, you know, he really is trying to do the right thing. You should help him. This is a good thing. Don't you want this? You're meant to do this. And John turns that down. And then we're not going to leave it there. One more try. Melisandre decides that she's going to try to convince him to join their cause. She takes a little bit of a different approach, though.
She tries to seduce him.
Right.
Like, oh, I know you know what this does. And I know you know how a woman's body feels. Let me show you mine.
Do you not understand that John's all about the honor? Like, I don't understand how she thought that would work. She probably should have tried magic, even though he was not interested in that either.
Put a pin in that one. But this is her trying to come onto his male side and trying to lure him away. And he still has these feelings for Grit. So he's still loyal to this lost love, even if his loyalties to the Night's Watch failed for Ygritte. he still holds his loyalty to her as well. So he doesn't let her persuade him. And then she goes to leave and she drops a bomb, like this little tiny bomb that just kind of makes Jon go, what the hell? She says on her way out the door, you know nothing, Jon Snow.
Well,
Ygritte never met, what's her name? The lady in red, Melisandre.
Melisandre.
Yeah. So if, how did Melisandre get that little quote right there? If
a Harry Potter reference, priori incantatum, but on Jon Snow's face.
Yeah. So that was, that leaves Jon a little bit spun right there, but, that's Jon's place to be, actually. I think Jon works best when he doesn't quite know
best
what's going on.
Spun. Much like cotton candy.
And title.
And scene.
All right. So yes. Other things that Jon's doing while he's in control. Well, he names Alistair as First of the Watch. Is that right? Do I have that title right?
I actually wrote it down here. Let me find it. I believe so.
And then he asks Lord Janna Scaredycat to go take over a certain area that basically needs to be rebuilt. And Lord Scaredycat,
it's like basically the end of the wall by the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, Lord Scaredycat doesn't want to go do that. He says no. He's refusing the Lord Commander's order.
Yep.
And Jon says, this isn't a suggestion. This is a command. Are you going to defy me? And he makes a big scene. Yes, I am. Of course, this is Lord Scaredycat, but you know, he's right. Putting on a big show for everybody. And well, Jon kind of calls his bluff and, just to get down to it, doesn't show mercy, cuts his head off.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
This was
prison rules.
This was an interesting scene in that immediately beforehand, Jon is told, hey, you're going to have to do something with them because they're going to try to usurp you in some way or shape or form. They're going to undermine your authority. Yep. So Jon has this thing, this one chore. Was it like cleaning out digging in a new poop
latrine?
Yeah, poop latrine. And he looks at Alistair Thorne and then directs it to someone else and then appoints Alistair Thorne as first man of the watch or whatever.
Which was smart.
Which kind of, you know, opens the fold a little bit, like, hey, here's an olive branch. Let's work this out. I'm not, you know, going to demean you. I understand where you are and the authority that you hold. So I'm going to get you into my fold. But at the same time, Janos Slynt is a complete, he's a seed of doubt, and he can feed Alistair Thorne these little tidbits and keep this rebellion, mental rebellion going. So he's going to send General Slynt away, and of course he sends him way the hell away and basically challenges his dignity and his fear. General Slynt folds and says, no, I'm not going to go. They go to grab him because defying the Lord Commander's orders is punishable by death. And that
you guys,
leads him
to... Wolf.
That leads Jon to...
Go get Jon Snow!
Either accept it or punish him for it. And he goes and he punishes him for it. And at the end, Janna Slynt is begging for mercy, begging for mercy, begging for mercy. But Jon has a statement to make, and he makes it.
Mm.
And I didn't think he would. I didn't think he would go through with it. So I think that's a big moment when he actually goes through with it there. Big, smart move. Now, one more thing happened with Jon, and that's simply that he kind of had to agree with Sam coaxing him a little bit to get some help from Roose Bolton because they don't have enough men up there.
Yeah. Yeah, and Sam tried to get it all on the sly, too. He tried to just slide the paper in there.
Yeah, here, sign these 20 things. Wait a minute, what's this one? Damn.
Yeah. But true to his word, he wants to bolster the wall, so he signs the letter and sends it off.
Yep. So a lot of good scenes with Jon. I think we've kind of established now that he is in command. He is actually doing a pretty good job. I thought he would immediately hate the limelight, but he seems to have taken well to it and made the hard decisions, which I thought would be harder for him to make than they demonstrated. So I'm kind of happy about that.
And even as Lord Commander, he's down with the Watchers, the Watching Watchers. He's down with them doing physical training, doing sword play, and he's not just directing it. He's partaking in the training itself because he knows he's probably the best swordsman they have there. He's the one with the classical garrison training and everything else. So he's taking a firsthand approach to making sure that his men get trained properly.
Yep. Yeah, and also, like, on the tough authority situation, it's so much easier to be mean and a jerk when you're doing it on behalf of your job than when you're doing it for yourself. And I think that's what you're seeing in Jon. Whenever he's in a leadership position, he does not have a single problem in being on charge. It's just when he's, trying to be a good person.
Good point. All right, want to take a quick 2-minute trip to Crazyville?
There's so many of them to take. Which one do you want to go with first?
So, dude who is trying to resurrect the mountain is killing rats, and we see what we assume to be the mountain stir on Frankenstein's table. Ugh. Weird.
And now we have Franken Mountain.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's pretty much all there is to that. That's it.
Yeah, that's that. This is just totally creepy. This fits right in with him taking the skulls. Like, no, give me the dwarf head. Put it right over here. So gross. So gross.
I'll take that.
Okay. So moving on.
Can we talk about Jamie?
Oh, please.
Yes, let's. He's very delightful.
All right. And seriously, who would expect that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, this monster is actually doing something respectable, going after his daughter. Oh, I'm sorry. His niece, in quotes.
Yeah, did you like how Bronn challenged him on that?
Absolutely. Bronn knows damn well what's going on. Yeah. So we first see Jaime when he and Bronn are on this merchant ship, and they're just bantering about, okay, why are we doing this? Like, of all people, why are you doing this? This makes no sense. Oh, well, I have to go after my niece. Oh, your niece? And so we later see them. They're rowing on a small boat on their way to land, presumably. Next, we see more banter. Next, we see them on land, and they're continuing to have some discussions. Bronn saves Jaime from a snake that was about to probably bite and kill him.
Yeah.
And then shortly thereafter, they're about to be found. So they basically let themselves be discovered by some horsemen on Dorne.
Try to talk their way out of it.
At Dorne.
Yeah.
What's that?
They try to talk their way out of it.
And right, they're basically figuring they'll be able to fight their way out of it. Bronn asks Jaime, how many can you take on? One if he's slow.
Yeah.
So Bronn ends up taking on the rest when they do in fact turn on them. And it was, I think, a really cool fight scene. We get a horrific moment. Again, I hate when we see any animal violence at all. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that Bronn attacks one of the soldiers is by cutting off the legs of his horse.
Yep.
And that's kind of, that's just awful. But
to me, that's like not fair play.
Well, it's because it's not what an honorable person would do. But keep in mind, we're talking about Braun here. He's a survivalist, not an honorist.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. And then we get what I think is a really good fight sequence with Jamie.
Yes. And again, going back to season one, we told you don't look at these fight scenes as the end all because they get better. And here we have expertly shot. It gives you kind of multiple views of the shot from down the hill, from up top, from behind Jamie, from, you know, facing Jamie. And the choreography is amazing. And the flow of the battle itself, it feels realistic. It feels like you're almost there watching it.
Yes.
And you're feeling for Jamie, like Jamie's defending his life. He's at a disadvantage, and he manages to fight pretty well and kind of has basically wins the fight with a twist when he uses his fake hand to grab the sword coming at him.
Right, which is like one of those things, why didn't you think of that before? like shouldn't you have a battle version of that golden glove that's kind of a little more open to where you could use it a little more effectively? But you know, maybe instead of being completely made of gold, it's got some wrought iron in there, something a little stronger than the soft gold of his hand. You know, this is one of those things, like when it happens, is like, why wasn't he doing that the whole time? Why weren't they training that way? That's talking about being able to throw somebody off. Yeah, you're missing your good arm, but they're not used to people being able to grab their blades. Come on, man.
Right. That was really cool. I love that. So he ends up killing that guy, and they're now in a position where now they need to proceed to the city so that they can get his, quote, niece. Now, Bronn, meanwhile, is asking him, what's to make you think that ship captain didn't sell us out?
A bag of gold.
Oh, right. Yeah, a big bag of gold. Yeah. Don't worry about it. Well, yeah, Bronn was right. Basically, the ship captain did sell them out, as we see in a scene with Ilaria, where she and some sand snakes are basically making the decision to go to war and avenge Oberyn.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that Jaime's on the way because, sure enough, he's only alive for, I don't know, maybe 67 seconds, something like that. But there's the ship captain.
They have him buried in the sand with just his head exposed, with a rag around his face or around his mouth so he can't talk, and scorpions in and around his head while he's got a bucket over his head maintaining the scorpions right there. Like, this is the old rat burying its way through the belly thing, except kind of opposite of that. Like, it's genius. It shows the viciousness of the sand snakes, and then when Ilaria is like, are you in or out? And the one sand snake throws her spear through the captain's head. Well, okay. I guess that answers the question. These are some bad bitches and they're coming.
Oh, I'm in. You know, I'm very in.
My only issue with the sand snakes is that it always seemed like everything that happened with them was in a snow globe. Right? Like, it doesn't ever feel connected to the rest of the storyline.
Right. So it always feels tangential.
Like, and forever. I mean, they're cool, but they're like cool in the desert and no one's paying attention.
Yeah. As their story goes along, they could have been better utilized as a mm-hmm. theme in the story. However, as tangential as they are to the main arc of the story, it's still important that they're there. So it's they're in this like muddy middle ground where we want more of them or we want them gone, but they never quite fulfill what we feel they should do. But the story wouldn't move along the way that it does without them. So,
yes.
Yeah. So for future producers out there, more sand snakes. Okay?
Yeah.
All right.
Plus, they're not hard on the eyes, even with their weird armor and stuff. I'm just saying.
Sure.
And these are all Oberyn's children. These are all Oberyn's bastard children from different mothers. So you have his sister, wife, lover thing. And then the three underlings are all his bastard daughters.
Got it. Okay. I didn't realize that was another incestuous royal family thing going on there.
I don't know that it's not, but I can only imagine as free love as they are in Dorne, that it's more likely to be than not to be.
I wish there was a podcast for faces I'm making right now. Just call it Faces I'm Making Right Now, and it's a silent podcast, but I'm just making faces. Mm.
You can just hear the ruffling of a shirt moving as you make the different faces.
Yeah, just like shaking my head.
You could totally do something with that. You should look into that. You should totally do something.
It'd be in the ASMR, like to the extreme, right?
Yeah, right.
All right. Anything else with the Sand Snake Weird Dorne people?
I think that's it. I think that's all they accomplished this time around.
Okay, let's talk about my favorite character, Tyrion.
Mm.
Tyrion's had enough of the box. He gets out of the Winnebago and wanders in. What did you call this place? The Long Bridge to somewhere?
It was in
Tipperary.
The
Tipperary. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
So there's this long bridge that also apparently has housing on it and markets and stuff like that. A lot of people out on this bridge, and
the long bridge of Volantis. The long bridge of Volantis.
Okay. He's wandering around and trying to convince Varys that it's safe. They'll be fine. They won't be spotted. Look, I'm just another drunk dwarf. How's anybody going to notice me? But he does get noticed because he goes into a brothel where Jorah happens to be hanging out, watching
moping.
A bunch of people kind of ogle over a fake Queen Daenerys in the brothel.
Right.
Such a weird, sick scene.
I mean, it just goes along with the whole roleplay fantasy that a lot of people interject, except this is available on demand.
Sure. All right. Sure. Yeah, so we get some interesting wordplay, as we always do with Tyrion. Nothing that was notable enough that I wrote down. But he does talk to some woman there who he pretty much then ends up just leaving. He's like, nope, can't do this. I'm going to go. Has a quiet moment by himself, peeing in off the or out of the window of what I presume to be a room where he's staying. And we see Jorah come up behind him and capture him,
mm-hmm.
jump to the next episode, the first scene, and in fact, Jorah has basically kidnapped him and taken him aboard some boat that he steals.
Right. Because that's what Jorah does. He's a smuggler, right? Oh, no, he's a slaver. Kind of the same thing.
So eventually, Tyrion wakes up. These two talk, and...
Whoa. Tyrion wakes up and decides he needs to talk, but he's got a gag in his mouth, so he starts humming.
So he starts singing.
Yeah, just...
with a gag in his mouth to annoy Jorah enough to take the gag out of his mouth. Yeah, that was funny.
And then only to find out that Jorah is taking Tyrion to his queen. Oh, by the way, the same place that Tyrion was already going, and Tyrion's... Tyrion's right. reply to that, oh, what a great waste. Oh, what a waste of a great kidnapping.
That's right. That was a good line. I forgot about that. Yeah. Yeah. But I love that moment where it's like, we're all going to the same place. This is exactly where I was headed. Yeah. That was funny. That was really funny. And that's pretty much it for Tyrion, but that's a good transition to Dany, because this is when we get back to see Daenerys just blissfully looking out over the land, imagining that everybody's so happy, but people aren't really happy. In fact, you know, we have this whole group of people that want to play these fighting games where they're going to end up killing each other, but she doesn't want to have it. And she can't be convinced that these traditions are important to the people. Meanwhile, the Sons of Harpy are attacking again and set a trap for her soldiers.
Yeah, this is one of those things where the blissful ignorance of one's own station comes back to haunt them. Mm-hmm. And they make the assumption that, oh, we've got control of the city. We're peacefully controlling the city with our presence, until the presence itself is what is what people are trying to defy. And that comes down to a lot of blood.
A lot of blood. So an outnumbered group of soldiers do hold their own fairly well with a continually coming, it seems like never-ending supply of, you know, a dozen more Sons of Harpy just keep on flowing in. And eventually we're in a position where Grey Worm's life is in danger. And we see Barristan Selmy, I believe that's who that was, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who went down into the city really just to kind of walk in the city and be seen and make sure that things are going okay, and they're not going okay. He hears the fight. He comes to Grey Worm's aid, fights heroically, and gets killed.
Mm-hmm. I hated this death.
Yeah.
I hated it, but as soon as he went in there, I knew that was going to happen.
Yeah, this is kind of the Sturm moment for anybody that's read Dragonlance. The valiance is rewarded by the valiant death, and that's never happy.
And we also don't necessarily know whether Grey Worm survives at the end of this episode, although it seems unlikely that his injuries were as dire as the stab through the heart that Barristan Selmy had.
Right. And this is kind of foreshadowed earlier in this same episode when Peter is talking to Sansa in the crypts, and she says, well, Rhaegar Targaryen, the last riders of the day for the ceremony were Rhaegar Targaryen and Barristan Selmy. And they go at it. Barristan Selmy loses, and Rhaegar goes and lays the wreath of winter roses at Lyanna's feet. So it's kind of foreshadowed in that way, even though it's still unexpected when it happens.
I somehow missed that entire conversation.
Yeah.
Like, well, if that's what they were discussing in the catacombs,
yeah,
that was just, that went right over me.
Yeah. There's actually, that scene is one that you will revisit. Now that you know that Barristan Selmy dies, you can go back and revisit that scene there, and there's a certain look on Peter's face that gives away another secret that won't actually come out until season 6. Like, Peter knows too much, and yeah, Peter is Peter.
Baelish?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, put a pin in that one as well, because once some things come to light in season 6, or maybe even season 7, you can go back and watch that scene, and there's a certain look on his face at the end of the conversation where you now know that he knows more than what you think he knows. So,
Okay.
Pin distraction averted. What happens next?
All right, well, so we're basically left with the world around Cersei. And there's a lot of shit going down there.
It's almost the world according to Cersei, because she really does a number on several people. She's starting to place pawns all over the world in control of exactly where she wants them to be.
Yeah, okay. I can see that. All right. So we basically start these episodes with Cersei really unhappy about the attention that Margaery is getting as she's marrying Tommen in what is arguably the shortest wedding in any of the Game of Thrones episodes that we've watched.
Yeah, what color would you assign this one?
What color?
Yeah, because we got the red wedding, we got the purple wedding. This is...
How about green, as in Tommen is kind of green?
There we go. The green wedding. Also, it's the most innocent of all the weddings, because nothing happens outside the wedding.
I would call it the illegal in any modern society wedding.
you're married, kiss, get out of here.
Yeah, your bastard child from your brother who's underage is married. Never mind. Anyway. So, I mean, you know, it's like you can't even, I can't even go back far enough to figure out where that went bad.
So, yeah, if that was the first scene someone had seen and you had to explain how it got to that point, that would be, whiskey would have to be involved for any understanding of that.
Yeah, yeah. So that was their wedding. And then very quickly, we're in their wedding night, or he just finished having his first sex.
Yes.
And is absolutely amazed by it and just wants to do it forever from now on. That's all he wants to do anymore.
Welcome to being 13.
But alas, his wise queen, Marjorie, reminds him that he needs to be king now. There are important things that he needs to think about. Oh, and by the way, your mother, Cersei, it's adorable that she's still here and looking after you while you're king. Is that really what you want?
Yeah, she starts
That's
playing
the
her
first thing I did to my mother-in-law.
This is Marjorie moving her pawns around. And it's beautifully constructed. The way she brings it up at the moment of ecstasy for Tommen, like everything's just flowing in all cylinders for her right now.
You guys, my podcast, Silent Faces I'm Making During This Discussion, is just taking off.
At this point, she's already recorded 5 episodes, unbeknownst to anyone.
I've recorded 5 episodes of Silent Disgust.
Yeah.
It's a mini series.
Yeah. It's a micro podcast.
Oh man. Wow. So Marjorie and Cersei get an opportunity to talk. Cersei kind of walks into Marjorie, who I guess is telling her what would they be? Her friends, her court? What would you call these women that she's hanging with, giggling with, presumably about her first time with little Tommen?
Her ladies in waiting.
There you go.
And this is the first time they start power playing each other. Meaning Marjorie and Cersei.
Yep.
They power play each other, and Marjorie comes out on top on this one. And it doesn't sit well with Cersei at all. Because as Cersei's getting ready to leave, Marjorie asks her, so if I'm now the queen, what does that make you?
Dang.
Yeah, it's not a pretty place. So
and she does it in a very
It's a controlled and manipulating way.
She doesn't come out and say that. She's like, I forget, what am I to call you now?
Yeah, it's very coy. It's very sly. It's beautiful.
And then again, rapid sequence of scenes here. Next thing we have, conveniently enough, Tommen is asking his mother as they walk along the shores, are you sure you don't want to go back home? Wouldn't you much rather be at Casterly Rock?
Yeah, exactly. Isn't it time you returned home to nest?
That goes well, let me tell you.
Yep. So now we get into the rest of Cersei's power play.
Yeah, so we have this weird scene where the High Scepter is in the brothel, and the sparrows kind of invade the brothel and drag him out of there and shame him. And that somehow leads us to Cersei.
Yeah, well, this is...
Help! I don't understand how that happens. She decides that she's going to go pursue the head of the sparrows, the High Sparrow, if you will, and just kind of make nice with him. I don't understand where this came from. It seems like this situation just conveniently landed in her lap by no specific effort of her own.
This was really more a matter of Cersei is very smart when it comes to the ways of the game, and she sees a new player and she wants to get that player into her fold. She wants to have that player on her team. So instead of ignoring the High Sparrow, she goes and approaches him and says, hey, we can work together. I can help you get what you want and you can help me get what I want. Although she doesn't say that, that's essentially what comes out of it. And it, she's right, because this is another pawn for her to play. And she can kind of make those moves now, because the High Sparrow is not necessarily on her side, but understands her value.
Oh, and by the way, it just so happens that the High Sparrow is played by Jonathan Pryce. Brilliant. I love him as an actor. So I'm actually really excited to see where that goes. But his interest is, yeah, he just, you know, they exist basically to punish those who sin. That's what they want to do. They just want to punish the people that are sinning.
Yes.
If you've ever wanted to see someone play wicked, tricksy, and passive aggressive all at one time, this is the role of a lifetime for you.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, I was really glad to see that. So she's getting in bed with him, metaphorically only, of course. Well, I don't know why I say of course, but
shame, Richard.
The idea being that
shame.
Yeah.
The priest, shame.
The idea being that she could use someone that's going to go help her expunge some bad people. Oh, and by the way, I know of someone who's really, really bad. I mean, me, yeah, it's rumored that I might have had a few kids with my brother, but we're not going to talk about that. We'll instead talk about my other brother's former lover, yeah. Loris.
This is, oh my gosh, the way this goes down, because she first of all, she rids herself of what's his name from Dorne, her master of coins. She says the Iron Bank needs to be renegotiated with. So why don't you go and do that? And of course, she sends him with Illyrio Martell. Is it Illyrio? With one of her swordsmen. And that's not going to end well. And everybody knows it. But he's giddy because he gets to go talk to the Iron Bank. So he leaves.
Oh, right. And by the way, one less person. Oop. Wow. That was bad. Of all the shows to do that wrong on. One less person on the small council.
Yes. And the comment is made, the small council grows smaller every day. And her response, it's not enough.
Not small enough.
And then she confronts the High Sparrow and he says, well, I'm here to rid the world of evils and this and that. And she says, well, you used to have the Faith Militant that was armed and could, you know, had the will of the king to, or the power of the king to follow the will of the Lord. And she says, well, what if I could help you get that? And he's kind of passive about it. And then she says, well, what if I could tell you someone who's riddled with sin, hidden behind the veil of gold, and whose title and powers have enabled him to continue sinning, and I could deliver that person to you. And that,
in other words, my dead brother's former lover. Wasn't that much easier? Come on, that's a much easier way of saying that.
Right, but the way she frames it, she's talking about herself at the same time.
Oh, see, I didn't even catch that symbolism. Okay.
Yeah, she's literally talking about herself, but she frames it in the way in which the Faith Militant now goes and grabs Sir Loris, and well, now they have him, and Marjorie's not happy.
No, understandably, Marjorie's not happy, and she knows who's behind this. Clearly, Cersei has done this. She confronts Tommen. Tommen says, oh, well, I will put an end to this. Tommen confronts his mother. His mother says, I'm not holding Loris. What can I do? You're the king. Meanwhile, she's the one who's been, you know, playing all the cards and making all the moves. Why don't you go talk to the High Sparrow? So he goes out to talk to the High Sparrow. And here is the scene where it's just heartbreakingly obvious how ill-prepared he is for the position he's in.
Yeah, basically the Faith Militant are protecting the stairs to the Septon. And they say, well, the High Sparrow is praying, so you can't go in. And Tommen just backs down, says, well, we'll find
And his guard way. Says, we'll clear them.
Right.
He says, well, what do you mean? You, kill them?
Yeah.
And yeah. he's like, no, we'll figure out another way. Meanwhile, all of the people in the street, as he made his way there, are jeering him, calling him bastard and abomination. Yep. And it made me wonder, does he have any awareness whatsoever of what the people think of him and know of how he was conceived?
Right. Does he know how he was conceived?
Right.
Like, it's a big ball of mystery to try to unravel, and it doesn't turn out very well.
Yeah. So that was a, and you know, he goes back to his quarters and goes to see Marjorie, and Marjorie's understandably unhappy. So she's like, no, I'm going to go be with my family. I'm going to deny you me while you figure this out for me.
Because this is how you train dogs.
Aww. I felt for Tommen, because this was a hard moment for him, where he realizes he doesn't know what to do. He doesn't have the guidance of his grandfather. He's being manipulated by his mother, whether he's aware of it or not. I think he may be, but doesn't necessarily want to admit it.
Yeah.
And now he's losing the one thing that he cares about, his wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, that's Tommen in a nutshell.
Aw, that was sad. All right. So that was pretty much it for most of the story here. There was one thing that we forgot to talk about up at the wall, a tender moment with someone who is not known for being tender.
Yeah, Stannis and his daughter, Meereen. Is it Meereen? Not Meereen.
Shireen.
Shireen, there we go.
I only know that because I wrote it down. I mean, I'm still never going to remember all these names.
you get Shireen's origin story. Basically, how she got the grayscale is basically a trick by a trader who Stannis didn't want to deal with because he had crap goods. Got a little doll. The doll was infected with grayscale, however. So when she pushed it to her cheek as an infant, she caught the grayscale. He called in every maester. They stopped the infection from spreading to other people and to the rest of Shireen's face and body. And that was it. And that was, it's kind of like a, everyone wanted to get rid of you and I kept you here. I'm proud of you. I love you as my daughter. And, it's not that you aren't appreciated. It's just that people don't know how to show it. And so he shows it in that moment.
He is asked, are you ashamed of me? He never answers that question. He tells the story. He says, you are my daughter. You are the princess of whatever. But he never says no. And that bothered me.
Let's be clear. Stannis is a dick.
And even when she runs into his arms, he stands there with his arms down and then kind of eventually returns something of an embrace.
And again, this whole scene was placed here for foreshadowing, and it's
one double of the, foreshadowing.
Yeah, it's one of the deepest, saddest storylines to develop. And man, we're getting ready to get into some very powerful story arcs here. And
but also, you know, I won't say what, but it is foreshadowing an entirely separate storyline, which is actually so awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, good.
Yeah, which I mean,
like two for the price of one, which I think is like really great writing.
Yeah, there's, yeah, so good.
All right, we're not going to go into that any further now because we have more episodes where we'll be talking about other episodes of Game of Thrones. Next time, we're going to talk about 505 and 506, and we're looking forward to that. But in the meantime, if you people that are listening, if you want to tell us what you're thinking or you have questions for us, Anthony, where do they send all all of those messages. I know that it's been hard for you to keep up with all the mail we've been getting, but I think you should tell them again anyway, because I don't want to just shut it down for fear of it getting filled up.
It's letstalkaboutthrones@gmail.com.
Just write us an email that says, I'm here.
Kind of like a, what was that movie? We are here, we are here, we are here. The Lorax. Mm-hmm. We know there's an audience out there somewhere.
Before we close this out, I want to say that this season, The Worst to Come, The House of Black and White, the titles for the first couple episodes followed right along with the episode. This one was The High Sparrow and Sons of the Harpy. Again, follows right along with the episodes. That's a trend that is going to continue. And the next two episodes, Kill the Boy and Unbowed, Unbent, Unbroken, maintain that thread. Mm. They're starting to be descriptive, and it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. All right, good to know. I will look for that. So in the meantime, where can people look for you, Anthony?
You can find me on Twitter at Ethan Kane, ethancaine. Jenny?
I'm doing so much.
You are.
The most interesting thing I'm doing right now is writing a little newsletter about independent podcasts, the ones that you don't hear about, the ones that aren't on the chart, but the ones that are still changing people's lives. And it's called All the Other Podcasts. And
it's like
is
the kind of
weekly
podcast that we do.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty cool. And so, yeah, I just was frustrated and fed up with the fact that, you know, there isn't an outlet for that. So I made one. So you can subscribe.
You had this graphic in your, I don't know if you're using it in every newsletter, but I saw it in the first one where you basically point out how, you know, all the big names, the NPRs and all of those companies, when the populace thinks of podcasts, that's who's getting recognized.
My favorite moment of putting this newsletter out was I posted it on Facebook and I was like, it's all about independent podcasts, the podcasts you don't hear about, this, that, the other thing. And one of my like distant cousins wrote, have you heard of Serial? They were like, have you heard of Dirty John? And I was like, yes, thank you for these recommendations.
Yes. As a matter of fact, you just made my point.
As people wade their way into the pool of podcasting and they start becoming comfortable with what's there, it's the central podcast that they always gravitate towards. And there's so many others on the outskirts that are impactful, entertaining, and just fun to listen to and that you can get something out of. And that's what the newsletter is about. It's ridiculous. It's good. And it's three newsletters in so far. And I've enjoyed three of them. They're amazing.
Well, you know, find me on JennyJ23 on Twitter and you can find a link to subscribe.
Yep.
All right, good stuff. And then you can find me at Richard Gunther on Twitter. And I just got back from CES. So a lot of my recent posts are CES or tech related, including a video episode that we just did of the show I co-host, Entertainment 2.0. We recorded on the floor at CES, which was a lot of fun. So that is going to do it for us this week. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next time when we talk again of Thrones.
Talking of Thrones.
Bye-bye.
And Jenny just said goodbye when one of her faces.
I did a face goodbye.